Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners. And I can still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by betonline.ag. NFL Week 15, Monday Night Football Edition. And this, Payne, unfortunately, is a bit of a somber day around here. I'll get to it in a second, though. It is the last Monday Night Football podcast for us this fine football season. I am, of course, Todd Furman, joined as always by the one, the only, Payne Insider.
Sad day. Season's flown by. That's one thing that's been happening here. Very quick. Now, I could use a little break, but
a break from the podcast or a break from me? Where are you going with this?
I was trying to be nice. I was trying to give that corporate response. A break from the podcast, of course.
Oh, okay.
Get a couple days off, you know. That kind of thing. We're a little late recording this morning. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, fiascos is more like it. As we watch the market go absolutely haywire at 10 a.m. Eastern on Monday mornings, it's a little bit bizarre, the world we live in these days, and I guess the world that we will continue to see going forward. Big Monday show planned, obviously. Not only will we recap what we saw over the weekend, Dr. David Chow joins us. You can follow him at Pro Football Doc to talk about some of the marquee injuries, not only to the players this past weekend, but what they mean going forward. Look ahead numbers. We have a preview for Saints and Panthers tonight. And Payne, a little throwback style, we may have to sneak in a little movie review Monday since we both took in the same flick over the weekend.
Yeah, when are we doing that? Are we doing that right now?
No, we're not going to do that right.
First.
No, we're not doing that right now. We're going to get to that. First, I want to talk.
Organized here.
I'm trying to be organized. Yeah, since when are you organized on a Monday podcast? You wing this thing more often than not.
All right, let's move on.
All right, let's talk about what we saw over the weekend. We may as well start with Nick Foles' swan song. It's not even a swan song. It's deja vu all over again. Going on the road, winning in Los Angeles. The Eagles outright as 13.5, 14-point dogs. 6.2 yards per play. They win the turnover battle. I mean, does this say more about the Eagles' fight at this point, or should we start to be concerned about the Rams and what this team's going to be, not only for the final 2 weeks of the regular season, but headed into the playoffs?
A little of both. I missed part of the first half, obviously. About this movie, right? Went to a movie. So I didn't think this was going to be much of a game. Although once it got to 14, I thought there was probably some value on Philly. But I kind of dug back into it. Did watch the second half. Looked at a bunch of our numbers this morning. And from what it appeared to be in the first half, the game plan was awesome. The play calls were pretty good. Foles did his thing. I was looking at this 6.5 yards per play on the first 10 drives. So it was like 47 snaps total. And so we kind of got that Super Bowl look from Foles, I guess. The last four drives, though, were just terrible when kind of the pressure was on Foles. I watched those. He kind of reverted back to, the guy that a lot of people thought he was going to be start that game. 29 total yards on 16 plays, and then he had the pick, which gave the Rams life. I was hoping to go to sleep early, but of course that pick kept me up at that point. So a little pissed at Foles for that. I think, though, you touched on probably the right point. There was the Rams offense, and they are struggling mightily the last three games. And, you know, you can certainly pinpoint, hey, you know, good Bears defense in the cold, that's a bad spot. But there's really no excuses for the game against the Lions in the Dome. And then last night, the Eagles secondary is just decimated. And I always talk about looking at these trend lines. In the last 3 weeks, Rams 26th in passing success rate, 18th in rushing. Goff has been like this turnover machine, 7 picks, 1 touchdown. You sprinkle in that safety as well, which changed things. And I kind of want to go back to what we talked about. It looks like Goff is starting to miss Cooper Kupp. That offense is starting to miss Cooper Kupp. And it was his best friend off the field, and it was kind of his security blanket on the field. And I remember going back, and hopefully I don't butcher this, but we talked about it at the time of that injury, and we said, of all the passing receiving combinations in the NFL that had at least 50 targets, that Goff Cup combination was number one in the league in passer rating. And it just, it feels like he's missed from that offense. The other thing here that I noticed, the second big problem, and I don't know if you caught this or if you watched the second half or not, and I our goal here is to be fair and unbiased. And I think that's something that our podcast emphasizes and stresses. And I know a lot of people don't like to hear negative things about their favorite teams and players, but it's just, it's about being unbiased and honest. And so for as much as I've praised McVay, ooh, did he have a massive brain fart that basically cost his team last night. He called the final timeout after that Josh Adams run on first down at like the 2:45 mark. He shouldn't have done that, right? The Eagles forced, they were going to be forced to run a second play before the 2-minute warning anyways. So he should have saved that timeout for after the two-minute warning, and he didn't. So after the 2-minute warning, Doug Peterson calls run. The clock leaks down to like 1:13, and then Elliott misses the field goal. So basically, McVay butchering the timeout situation cost his offense and cost his team 40 seconds, roughly. And it was a massive mistake because they were pressed for time. I feel like they would have scored had another 40 seconds been on the board, and we would have seen that game and go into overtime, or we would have taken a page out of Andy Reid's playbook there and went for two.
Yeah, just incredible the way that whole game unfolded. So much still at stake for the Rams trying to avoid the dome. That doesn't look to really be much of a possibility now. Their remaining schedule, not that all formidable within the division. I believe they play the Arizona this week where they're heavy favorites, and I think they close with the 49ers. So it'll be very interesting to see what this Rams offense looks like, because they don't have that playoff pedigree. It's not as though this team has been there, done that, and you trust them to be able to flip a switch. Another team, Payne, that's going to get back to the postseason for the first time since 2013. We go way back to Thursday night. I'm not going to lie. I thought it was going to be the same old Chargers, Anthony Lynn getting outcoached by Andy Reid. They were going to go into Arrowhead, which has been a house of horrors. And then all of a sudden, over the final 5 minutes, they completely changed the narrative, and Phillip Rivers showed us a side of him that he hasn't shown against his Chiefs team.
I like how efficient that offense is. And they operate so freaking slow, and they have for a while now. If you look at some of the pace measures, I mean, it's just a slow offense. They had 9 possessions all game, and they put up over 420 yards of offense. It's just so rare to see a team that operates that slow be so efficient. I think you have to love the Chargers overcoming adversity. You know, they're down 3 defensive starters that are important. You're down Melvin Gordon, Austin Eckler, Keenan Allen leaves early with the hip injury. Now, with 8 minutes to go, I was looking at the live wagering. 8 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, the Chargers are 14-1 in live. So someone probably cashed in pretty good there. To me, though, and I don't want to take away what the Chargers did, but for me, it was about the Chiefs not being able to finish, right? When that game's on the line, one of the biggest stages, Andy Reid kind of fell short again. 3 minutes to go, you're an offensive guru. Your team's fate this season, I think, is determined by its offense. You go 3 and out and lose 5 yards in the process rather than bleed that clock with your 4-minute offense. So, you know, take nothing away from our beloved Chargers, Todd, but I thought Kansas City blew that game.
No, I'm not going to disagree with that assessment at all. What I did want to ask you, and I don't want to spend too much time dwelling on it because I know both these teams have marquee matches, which we'll preview in depth this coming Thursday. The play calling in that final sequence, you have your 4-minute offense. You obviously want to possess the football and not give the Chargers a chance. How much of that do you think is being negatively impacted by the absence of Kareem Hunt from the way you saw game play out?
Oh, absolutely. And I kind of hinted this when we broke this game down Thursday. By no means is this Kansas City offense bad, but if you look at all those 4 key metrics, success rate, both passing and rushing, explosiveness, both passing and rushing, Kansas City's starting to trend down just a little bit. It's that combination of being more familiar with Mahomes and Reid and what they want to do, but now you're without Kareem Hunt. Now you're without Sammy Watkins, and a lot of people laugh and say, oh, Sammy Watkins, but he is a guy who can win his matchup one-on-one at this stage. He is a speed element, which opens things up for the rest of the offense. Now, I kind of hammered the table 2 weeks ago. I said, hey, you know, after the Oakland game, I said, hey, maybe Damian Williams needs a few more carries. He was fantastic in that game, but he's not Kareem Hunt, you know, so they are going to miss Hunt. They are going to miss Sammy Watkins. Let's see what this Kelvin Benjamin thing looks like. He can't create separation, but there are going to be certain packages for him. They've only handed him a few packages. They don't expect him to learn the entire offense, but maybe he can be helpful within the red zone. But yeah, when you're without Hunt, you're without Watkins, it's basically Mahomes and it's basically Kelsey at this point. And Tyreek Hill, we know how good he is, but he's dealing with that heel injury. Now he's playing through it. He's gutting it out, but he's not 100% either.
Yeah, I mean, clearly they didn't look like the same dynamic unit I really thought when they got up 14-0 up. We've seen this story before. I don't really need to watch, and credit to the Chargers for battling back, doing something that's been extremely difficult, erasing two touchdown deficits on the road, not only against Kansas City, but also against the Steelers, something the teams in that role, I believe, are 3-78 was the stat that ESPN gave out, or Fox, excuse me. And then the Chargers have been in that spot three times.
Your pay is going to be docked butchering that one.
They're 2-1. Yeah, I mean, it happens. I don't pay attention completely on the on the bottom line or lower thirds when I'm watching on the telecast. But aside from
those, you don't know which channel you're watching these games on?
I don't know. I mean, let's be honest here. Between college basketball, the NBA, the NHL, and the NFL being on 17 networks, it all kind of blends together at this time of the year.
Can I throw out another odd praise? Because I'm shocked that I'm just thinking about this in my head. It's like bizarro world when you're pointing out McVay's flaws. I was a little surprised with what I saw from Mike Tomlin yesterday. And I was butchering him on my couch initially when he had too many men on the field on that critical 3rd-and-1, gave up an automatic first down. And then, of course, you had the blown coverage like the next play to Hogan, and I'm thinking just like, here we go again. But, you know, Tomlin's pissing down his leg once again. But, boy, that Steelers defense played well.
Yeah, Jim Herman, baby.
Yeah, we joked whether it was the Space Jam movie or Jim Herman, the former Giants linebackers coach who they brought in to help with defensive preparations this week. Whatever it was, that Steelers defense looked competent. And you back out that Hogan touchdown, or rather, you look at all the plays after the Hogan touchdown. Patriots only had 4.7 yards per play after the Hogan touchdown. So Mike Tomlin deserving some praise this week on the podcast, which is shocking on the same day you're going to eviscerate McVay.
No doubt about it. And of course, we'll see how the Steelers handle prosperity. They're on the road to New Orleans this coming weekend. Anything else, Payne, to really jump off the page of the good variety that you watched all weekend long?
No, not a ton. I thought the Tomlin thing was the shock. I wanted to shock and awe people there. That was the one.
Shock and awe.
We never give praise to Tomlin. It's always negative, but he was good.
Shock and awe is good, but for all the shock and awe in the good direction, there has to be a little bit of negative that comes along with it. And for me, I watched that Jacksonville Jaguars offense amass 192 yards against the Washington Redskins, 57 yards passing from Cody Kessler, not even four yards per play. I mean, my Lord, that team against a Washington Redskins team that looked dead on arrival the week before against the Giants. Maybe I give credit to the Redskins and Jay Gruden, but Jacksonville, Lord, do they have some issues.
Well, I think you have to give credit to Gruden, right? He basically won a NFL football game with an Arena League quarterback. And
hey, Kurt Warner's in the Hall of Fame. Kurt Warner's in the Hall of Fame, so you be careful what you say about Arena League quarterbacks.
He started in the Arena League and then made his way on once they discovered his talent. This is the opposite. This is a guy that can't really play in the NFL, figure out how to play. I believe he had a contract for the upcoming season with an Arena League team, so that's pretty shocking. Now, here's what's interesting, though. As bad as the Jags offense was, and I watched part of this game, it never really felt like they're going to lose it. And then you kind of watch how things unfold, and it was like the perfect storm for Washington. And like Josh Johnson completes this like ridiculous 3rd-and-15 pass that's 4 yards behind his receiver that gets like deflected into the air, and it gets caught. And that leads to a touchdown. And then Jaguars get it back. They're driving down the field. There is this phantom offensive pass interference call, which negates a first down and basically pushes them back further into field goal range, which would have been a long field goal, which then forced Cordy Kessler on the next play in a passing situation. And it's like a tip deflection overthrow that gets picked off. So there was a lot of crap that went on for Washington to win that game. But the one thing that I kind of want to point out that might be bigger is the final couple of weeks here. I think you have to question the mindset of the Jaguars. It would feel like they don't care at this point and they're trying to get the best draft pick, because Leonard Fournette is a team captain. He spent virtually the entire second half on the sideline, touched the ball once in the second half. He had 25 yards in that one touch. Hey, I only needed one, apparently. And then like after the game, if you're listening to Doug Marrone, he talked about wanting to see an undrafted free agent running back in Dave Williams. And so you had such a great week of practice and yada, yada, yada. So I think it'll be interesting to see if the Jaguars go full-blown tank the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have, I mean, be interesting to see. I mean, only short underdogs on the road at a team that I guess I don't want to throw Miami under the bus, being, because I don't believe either of us expected much. But this defense has now allowed 27 or more points in four out of the last five games. Gave up 220 yards rushing to the Minnesota Vikings, a team that couldn't run the football against you and I. I mean, what did you make of the Dolphins' performance up there in the Twin Cities?
Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be a good spot. I didn't expect much from Miami there. The Vikings were very sharp at straight at 6.5 and 7 after that initial dummy down, and basically was the sharpest teaser leg of the entire week from all the guys that I spoke to. But this is a beat-up team, right? The defense isn't very good. They're without Xavien Howard. I mean, if you look up and down that defensive roster, I mean, they're just decimated with injuries. And without your best guy in the secondary, that was big. They've had some injuries along the defensive line, especially in the interior of that line. It was just a horrific spot. It's just a defense right now that's giving up gobs and gobs of yards. They don't have the ability to get pressure on the quarterback. They're having trouble stopping the run. Their linebackers aren't the smartest combination. You're playing with two strong safeties in your secondary out wide. You know, they've moved Minka Fitzpatrick because he's been great and so versatile. Without Xavien Howard, you don't really have a second corner either.
They anything else from the bad department? I have something that I want to talk about, because Mike Tomlin, we bitch about all the time and basically pick apart everything he did. Obviously, there was a coaching performance on Saturday, but I want to save that for the ugly portion of the show. So is there anything else that you would group as bad that you witnessed during the course of the Week 15?
You know, nothing too crazy. Maybe Jason Garrett. I don't know what he was doing late in that game. I mean, once it's over, like, just call off the dogs. Like, you're down 23-0 with, like, 4.5 minutes to go. You're, like, handing the ball off to Zeke Elliott. Now, I know Philadelphia won, Washington won, and I think the in with the Dallas loss, their playoff odds dropped like 3%. They're now 95% to make the playoffs. But at the time of that game going on, they were like 98.6% chance to make the playoffs. And Zeke and Dak and Cooper are out there touching the ball in a 23-point blowout with 4 minutes to go. I almost lost my mind. If you're a Dallas fan, I don't know how you deal with Jason Garrett. And just when he thought it was like turning the corner, where he had like five great games in a row and they were like doing some nice things offensively and they were starting to like get competent, and they do have some tools to be a thorn in the side of a couple of these teams that they're going to face in the playoffs with their ability to run the ball and play defense. But it was like back to like brain fart Jason Garrett. Could you imagine if either of those big three guys got injured?
I was shocked that Ezekiel Elliott had the workload he did in that game. I mean, we talked about it and speculated that, hey, you know, this is a game maybe you take your foot off the gas a little bit. You mentioned the rushing record and everything else, but I couldn't believe how much he featured into their game plan. Knowing what was at stake, knowing that they were going to have three cracks to win the division against Tampa and the Giants coming up, that this game on paper we knew was going to be difficult for the Cowboys.
I felt like you knew something that I didn't. You were carrying that torch about the limited workload of Zeke.
No, Where did that come from? Purely speculative. Speculative looking at the schedule. I had no intel on it. And when you watch the game plan, I mean, Zeke got the requisite number of touches. He was out there in full force.
Yeah. Now, I thought that they were going to do a decent job stopping him in the ground game. And certainly, you know, they did an okay job. My fear was him catching the ball out of the backfield, where the Colts struggled defending the pass to running backs a little bit. And, you know, he had seven catches there. But I thought overall the Colts did a decent job stopping the run in the first half. Man, the Zebras. Damn, Dallas had every damn call there. But in those critical situations, I did like to see the Colts defense, the crucial stop there on fourth down. And again, it comes down to, you know, Jason Garrett and that offense not being overly creative there. It's like one of those situations where, like, hey, you're without Zach Martin. Maybe you want to be a little creative on fourth and short. Maybe it's not one of those situations where you like go bulk package now that you don't have like Frederick and you don't have Zach Martin. Like, maybe you can't just overpower everyone and go with your jumbo package to gain a yard. And sure enough, they got stopped on a couple short, third and short and fourth and short a couple times throughout that game.
Yeah, very interesting, but one performance that wasn't completely unexpected from Dallas, given the high level we'd seen out of them during their five-game win streak. And, of course, the ugly part of the NFL Week 15 schedule, Payne, the floor is yours. You can say what you want to eviscerate his coaching style.
You don't like Vance Joseph?
What, you mean it's not a good idea when you're down four and a fourth and short, you elect to kick a field goal so you can lose by one? You don't even cover the number with something stupid like that.
Not the closing number. That's for sure. Not any number, actually. Jesus. No. What did they close in that game?
I saw
open,
it got as
open
low.
4.5.
Yeah, got as low as 1, and then there was some resistance. I think it closed 1.5, 2 at most shops.
Okay, because there was talks potentially about coming back in on Denver once it got down that low, and it just never materialized. So, like, that whole game, I watched it. It's, like, one of those reasons, and it sucks, right? There's a reason why, like, the best in the world can win, like, 54, 55, 56, 57% of the time, like, long-term on straight bets minus 110. Because you can know the exact game plan. You can know exactly how these teams want and should play. But it has to unfold out there, man. Like, it has to come to, you know, to fruition on the field. There's a reason that total went from 44 to, like, 47.5. And it's because all week long the Broncos talked about tempo and this and tempo that and throwing the ball deep down the field and taking shots. And it was the first time you'd heard Vance Joseph be, like, open and adamant about doing that. Right, there'd been resistance there from him. Musgrave and Case want to do that, but there'd been resistance from Vance. But he was talking about it as early as like Monday, Tuesday, talking about taking these shots and going more tempo. And our reservation, I think, came about, and we mentioned this on Thursday's podcast, like it's nice to want to do that, but do you have the parts? And the parts operating that tempo and that pass-first system was Case Keenum and two rookie wide receivers. And so they couldn't really efficiently execute that style. The Vance Joseph decision there on the field goal, I think, tells you all you need to know about Vance Joseph. It literally depicts like everything we've said about him all season about wanting to be run first and how he was a conservative coach and a conservative team and he wouldn't let Musgrave be more aggressive. 4th and 1 from the 10-yard line, down 4 mathematically, like you go for it every single time. But when there's 4 minutes to go, you might not get the ball back. That was like the most ridiculous decision ever, and I'm shocked Elway, being an offensive guy, didn't like fire him on the damn spot.
Yeah, I mean, every time I watch games, nothing seems to surprise me, but then there are those spots where you go, wait, what did I just see? And that would definitely fall into that classification. Clearly, Denver going to have a lot of things to sort out this offseason, knowing Case Keenum one more year left on his deal, what they'll do at the head coaching position. I really can't see a scenario where Vance retains his job. And Denver will be featured prominently on Christmas Eve, a game that we'll break down Thursday on the Bet the Board podcast, maybe not in great detail, as they go up to the Bay Area to take on the Oakland Raiders. But Payne, time for a little bit of a look-ahead discussion, and only a quartet of games that I thought were really worth breaking down, at least at some level. Current number, the Panthers next weekend, and of course Carolina hasn't played yet this week, but you see that number adjusted down to about a 3.5-point home favorite against the Atlanta Falcons. Look-ahead there was 6. Speculative, I wasn't impressed by any stretch of the imagination with Atlanta hanging 40 on the Arizona Cardinals.
Game really flipped. So Atlanta came out a little slow. And you look at Arizona the last couple of weeks, they've had success against teams that they can run the ball on. And I thought that was going to be the case a little bit here against Atlanta. And right out of the gate, they get up 7-0. It looks like they're about to drive again and maybe go up 2 scores to set the tone of that game. And then you get like the fluke pick 6 off a deflection. And it completely changed the momentum of that entire game. But of course, within this line, right, it's Atlanta 1, Atlanta hangs 40. They look competent. Doesn't look like they've quit on the season. And then there's just that little bit of, hey, I'm looking, Carolina's at home. They're a 6-point dog. If they're to lose this game, which who knows if they're going to, but certainly the market says that, can we really, at that point, their season's done. Can we really make this game 6.5 in a division game with two teams that don't really have much to play for at that point? And I think that was partly of the thought process on why we reopened 3.5 here.
Very good point. And a game, I think, a similar scenario, but almost a role reversal. I don't know if that's quite the right term or how I want to try and set it up. But you're looking at the Vikings, a 5.5-point road favorite at betonline.ag to take on the Detroit Lions. The Lions stubbed their toe on the road against Buffalo, coming up 1 point short in a 14-13 decision. Look at number here, though, only had the Vikings -3. And I know Twitter, Payne, because Twitter can't lie, they were thrilled with the new-look Vikings offense, how physical they were running the football. Can we pump the fucking brakes? It was Miami. You went out there, you played with a chip on your shoulder. We see it time and time again. The Vikings are a different team home and road.
Absolutely. And fortunately, they'll be in a dome here again for this one. And Detroit recently has had some good success against Minnesota, that matchup. Now, I know they stubbed their toe earlier in the year on the road in Delvin Cook's first game back, but the last, I don't know, 8-10 games, Detroit's had this team's number. Now, this is your inflation game, right? You're paying a premium here to back Minnesota in the must-win spot, in the control your own destiny spot, and you're going to have a lot of that this time of year. Now, Detroit went on the road, won at Arizona, went on the road again, back-to-back weeks, played Buffalo outdoors. I thought they played better, and I was stunned how well they played yesterday, actually. Probably had multiple chances to beat Buffalo, and you're wondering what the spread for this game would be then. Let's see how high this thing gets, because I could certainly see an appetite if this gets to a direction that's close to obtaining seven.
You know what? And you bring up a good point. And we talk about it, and I think the casual observer doesn't make assessments based on what actually transpires in the field. They get blinded by the final score. I think Detroit was better yesterday on the road at Buffalo in the loss than they were on the road in the win against Arizona, where they needed that pick six to get some separation.
Would completely agree with you. And let's not forget, as bad as Miami was yesterday and as bad as a spot that was, there was an oh shit moment there for a lot of the Minnesota fans and players, because Kalen Ballage comes out of the half and runs one right up their ass, and all of a sudden it's 21-17, and Miami gets a stop and they get the ball back, and it's like, oh my god, they're down four, and it was like, this is just a dominating performance in the final scoreboard. I know it'll kind of, the box score was ugly, the final score was ugly for Miami, but there was a moment within that game where it certainly changed at 21-17 Miami ball right around the 40-yard line. And so it definitely ballooned back out. But that was also an interesting game there. But I have a feeling here at 5.5, maybe not. But if this continues to creep up and you see the public come in for that must win on Minnesota, it'll be interesting to see if there's some take back as it does get closer to seven.
No doubt about it. A game we've already seen get touched up a little bit from where it was on the opener. The Bears on the road to San Francisco to take on our bet the board beloved 49ers after back-to-back wins and covers for us. We see this game go from 5 on the open yesterday to 3.5 at betonline.ag. Look ahead number on this game, though, Payne, had the Bears a 6-point chalk.
Interesting. And, you know, listen, I'm certainly not going to make a case for Chicago. There is a reason San Francisco money continues to come in, and we discussed it ad nauseum last week about San Francisco. Nick Mullins is looking competent. Shanahan is a very good offensive coach. And when you parse out all the numbers and you just focus on Nick Mullins' games in yards per play net, yards per play adjusted, San Francisco with Nick Mullins has been one of the top five teams in the NFL. And it's been very underlying. Books haven't really caught on to it. Pro bettors are way ahead of the market on this one. And then I think you have to wonder just a little bit, going across the country after winning the division, what's the motivation here for Chicago? Now, for me, I would look at it completely the opposite way. And also, the potential for Eddie Jackson. Let's monitor that situation, that injury. He's graded out one of the best safeties in the NFL. He'd be a big loss from that defense, even if it is for 1 week. But my mindset would be, if I'm Chicago, there's no letdown here because we have the tiebreaker against the Rams. Sure, they have two games that they should win, but you're only a game back. You have the tiebreaker. You just need to finish with equal records, and you can get that bye. And that bye is massive, right? Just need two wins to get to the Super Bowl as opposed to three. So they're still playing for something here. And I also think, right, if you're Matt Nagy, in the back of your mind, you're like, man, Trubisky's struggling right now. I'd sure like to get him in rhythm here. And you can pass on this San Francisco defense a little bit. You would think, and that's probably not the mindset of these players, but if I'm Matt Nagy, I'm trying to rally these troops and get them refocused because I'm not in love with my offense right now. And that's pretty concerning.
Serious question. If you're the 49ers, and I'm not going to say they don't have a quarterback controversy because Jimmy Garoppolo is their guy, but when you go into the offseason, are you looking to try and deal Nick Mullins, or do you want to go into camp next year knowing that you have a number two quarterback that you can 100% trust? Should Jimmy Garoppolo, who's been injury prone during a short career, go down with, you know, for any extended period of time next season as well?
I mean, I think it's always nice when you have a backup that you can go to and your season might not potentially be lost. But at the same time, you're trying to make this Super Bowl push. So anytime that you can, you know, get back assets that would help in that regard, whether it's a couple draft picks, you know, they need some shoring up on the defensive side. They need linebacker help now after that situation went awry with the kid from Bama. They need help in the secondary. So there are positions of concern. They could use a number one wide receiver. So if you can move him for assets, I would probably go ahead and do that for sure.
Gotcha. I just wasn't sure of the mentality, and I know you put yourself in the GM shoes a lot better than I could in that particular spot. So be curious to see how that ultimately develops. The 49ers apparently doing what they do best, winning football games as home underdogs during the month of December for the second straight year. Last but not least, Sunday night, you've seen a little bit of a role reversal. Seattle was a one-point favorite on a look-ahead number. Kansas City on the road in the Pacific Northwest in prime time, a 2.5-point favorite at betonline.ag.
Obviously, the Sunday night game, so we'll cover this in really, really great detail on Thursday. So I don't want to go too far into it. But initially, you know, you thought with Kansas City stubbing their toe that there wouldn't be quite the line value you were looking for here. But then Seattle lost outright, and it looks like, you know, you potentially have that line value some bettors could be looking for. Seattle's defense, certainly significantly better at home. And so there's really two good matchups, and it becomes who can win that matchup. Is it going to be Kansas City through the air, or is Seattle going to be really able to drain the clock and limit the possessions of that Kansas City offense, keep Mahomes on the sideline with Seattle's ground and pound game? So this that really contrasting styles. It'll be a fun one to watch.
Man, those were kind words saying Kansas City stubbed their toe at home. I was going to say they pissed all over themselves or they shit the bed. But if you want to go stub your toe blowing a 2-touchdown lead as a, you know, 1-30 favorite, look at you, a kinder, gentler pain this time.
I'm in the Mahomes business, baby. I can't be too critical of him.
That's a very good point. But you know what's not gentle pain? The injuries that players go through. And we have a man to put everything in perspective.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
Joins us every Monday here on the Bet the Board podcast. You can follow Dr. David Chow on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. Some of the best information you can possibly find in real time regarding all of the biggest injuries in the National Football League. And Dr. Chow, last night we were dealt a little bit of a surprise as far as the winner in the Rams-Eagles game, but we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you, do we have a quarterback controversy brewing, or is Carson Wentz going to be out a lot longer than the Philadelphia Eagles are leading us to believe?
I don't see how Carson Wentz plays again this year, and this includes if they make it to the playoffs. And the reason why I say that is if you look at stress fracture, and they came out and said stress fracture, and this is kind of what I theorized. Stress fractures take a while to come on, and they take longer to heal. They heal much more slowly than an actual acute fracture. You could theorize 4 weeks, certainly 6 weeks. A lot of fractures can heal. Stress fractures don't work on that timeline. Doug Peterson is accurate to say that they expect this to heal or that it's going to heal in 3 months. I expect it to heal in 3 months too. It's not guaranteed to heal. There's no possible way the Eagles can delay that healing or potentially turn this into something that leaks into next year or, God forbid, become something that needs surgery by making it worse by having him play. The timetable for return on this and the healing, interval healing in another week, 2 weeks, or even 3 weeks is not great enough to change the situation. Early this week, Doug Peterson came out and said questionable for this week. And I wrote an article saying questionable. If that's the case, there's going to be a league investigation about the Eagles. He is at least doubtful, if not out. And sure enough, they downgraded him to doubtful and out. Expect that to be the case week 16 and 17. There is no current controversy.
That's interesting. And I had another question. I hate to put you on the spot, but it did involve, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles medical staff, which has changed over a little bit this offseason. But I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the comments of Emmanuel Acho, former Eagles linebacker. He kind of called out the Philadelphia medical staff is being suspect and, you know, making a push for basically the league to have a say with you know, doctors in the NFL and not the teams. What was your take on that maybe? And you know, as being a team doctor, have you maybe felt any pressure to up a timeline of a player so he can return quickly? Like, what have you seen with that?
Well, first of all, I saw some of the comments from Emmanuel Acho. I reached out to him on Twitter to invite him to come on my podcast to discuss the issues. I thought it'd be a very great topic. I want to hear his full point of view, and I want to not debate, but just you know, intellectually discuss what points are valid and where he might be misunderstanding or where he's absolutely right in terms of what goes on. He is graciously accepted. But today I'm not going to do him today for my weekly Monday podcast because he's on vacation in the mountains and he says he's not sure his cell service will be good. So I will do that. And I think it makes for very interesting listening. So I will be very open to discussing it with him. But here are some early things that I would say. If he wants to criticize the Eagles medical staff, I mean, he was there. That's reasonable for him to have his opinion there. But the medical staff that's there now is not the medical staff that was there when he was there. As you pointed out, been a very, very unusual, and I don't know that there are records kept of this, but I think it's unprecedented in the history of the NFL. The head orthopedist, the head internist, and the head athletic trainer were all changed over in an offseason after they won the Super Bowl. I mean, that's relatively rare to have the athletic training and medical doctor side changed over in a team that was in last place, to have both sides changed over. They had both sides changed over after they won the Super Bowl. So certainly unusual. So if there is something that someone that's criticizing the Eagles for their medical care over time from this year to the year before, et cetera, they're essentially criticizing the team and what the team is in doing with the medical staff or what have you. But, you know, I look forward to having a chat with him about his points. I mean, he probably has some very valid points. I mean, one thing that one of either he or someone else said, you know, that a veteran said, hey, don't get caught on film being healthy to a rookie in training camp. They just want to get you healthy and then they're going to cut you. There's some truth to that. You can't get cut unless you're healthy, or if you are cut, you know, you're potentially owed money if you're healthy. But, you know, to put that on the medical staff, I mean, I told my GMs all the overtime, don't tell me if he's the worst player on the team, he's about to get cut, or he's the best player on the team and we really need him. My job is to get him better. So don't tell me if you're about to cut a guy. I don't want to know. He might be my friend, et cetera. Did I feel pressure to get guys back on the field? Absolutely, I did. It's part of the game. However, the pressure came from internally, like I knew that was my job. And the external pressure, 95% of the time, came from the player himself saying, come on, let's go. Let me go. It didn't come from management. In the famous ACL tear, Phillip Rivers, 6 days, Nisko playing in the AFC Championship game. Hopefully I can stop saying the only one he's ever played in. Hopefully that will change this year. But it was Phillip Rivers that said, no, I'm playing after this Nisko. I don't care about my torn ACL. I mean, he was the one driving it. And I can tell you, in a private meeting between him, myself, Norv Turner, the head athletic trainer, Norv Turner, the head coach, told Phillip, we got this. Billy Volek has got this. You go take care of your knee. You're going to have a long career. So that drive came from Phillip. I can't speak to what happened in Philadelphia, but that's my experience.
Very interesting topic, and I'll definitely be listening to that interview when it comes out. A game that is most recent to us, Philadelphia played last night against the Rams. Todd Gurley doesn't seem to be himself the last few weeks. He's certainly a key cog to that Rams offense, and they just aren't as dynamic without him. I saw a heating pad on his knee. Is that something the Rams should be concerned about with Todd Gurley as they make their postseason push, Dr. Chow?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I did go back and scour the film from yesterday's game, and there wasn't anything significant or traumatic that I saw, and which leads me to believe, and there was some word that it's been something he's been dealing with. And the heating pad and on the exercise bike, most likely, good news, doesn't indicate any structural damage. But absolutely, he could be dealing with some sort of tendonitis or contusion. Structurally, he's fine. But obviously it's something he's dealing with, and it's possible it lingers some. I don't think it's going to be to a point where he's not playing, but as you point out, maybe potentially his effectiveness.
Interesting. And another tailback I wanted to touch on, Lamar Miller. He's really come on strong recently, injured his ankle Saturday night against the Jets in the first quarter, returned briefly in the second quarter, and then was finished after that point. Any concerns there with Lamar Miller's ankle?
Well, by video, it was an eversion ankle sprain, and I do believe he could have returned to the game, and he did for a little bit. But I think that was more strategic on Texans' part. He was on the sideline moving well and in a helmet that he certainly was available in emergency use, et cetera. But I think it was a matter of not wanting to make it worse as they move forward. So I'm not guaranteeing you he's going to play this next week, but certainly he's going to be very healthy come time for the playoffs, and I think that'll be important for the Texans.
Makes sense. And let's go all the way back to Thursday night. Two injuries from the Chargers-Chiefs games. Let's start with Keenan Allen. Vital part, obviously, to the Chargers' efficient offense. Left with the hip pointer. We know he has a few extra days, but how long do we expect Keenan Allen out, if he's out at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, the hip pointer, I mean, during the broadcast, they didn't say much at all. And by video, I always thought hip pointer and that's been confirmed now. Normally, if you leave a game with a hip pointer where you aren't able to inject it or get it to work, the following week is at risk. But I think with a little bit of extra rest being a Thursday game, even though I play Saturday, instead of 10 days, it's 9 days. I think that's what gives him a chance to try and go. So we'll see. But I do think he does have a chance to play because of a few extra days of rest, which is important in this injury. And I think Melvin Gordon, barring a setback, will be good to go. He was close on Thursday. Now with an extra 9 days, I think he will be good to go.
Good news for Chargers fans. And last injury from that game Thursday night, Kendall Fuller. He is the Chiefs' best player in the secondary so far. I know Eric Berry returned. But what do we know about this broken wrist for Kendall Fuller? How long will he be out? I'm hearing he needed surgery on that wrist.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know that he will miss any time.
Wow.
You know, Kansas, I think he can play through. I have some suspicion that he came into the game with the fracture. If you really look at it, and it was a follower that pointed it out and screenshotted it to me, I did not notice it in the game. So kudos to the Chiefs for hiding this information, so to speak. But he played with a thumb spica cast. And if you go to my Twitter timeline, you'll see the picture. So his thumb and wrist were casted, which most likely indicates a scaphoid fracture. And they probably timed out the surgery for literally, he probably had it scheduled for Friday morning after the game, knowing he would have a little bit of extra rest. And he played with that cast. I saw it most of the game when I went back and looked at it. And the way the cast looked, it was red in color. It was well hidden. It was low profile. That wasn't the kind of cast that you throw on in 5 minutes and put them back into the game. It was the kind of cast that you spent some time on pregame to make it look nice and fancy and hide that. I believe strongly that he will for sure be with the team in the playoffs. And I would even take a 50-50 bet that he'll play this week.
I got to love that. The gamesmanship that goes on to try and mask and hide some of those injuries to keep guys on the field for the biggest games down the stretch. And Dr. Chow, last but not least, we, of course, have a big game tonight. The Saints, an inside track to the number one seed in the NFC. Carolina just trying to keep their slim playoff hopes alive. Cam Newton, clearly not himself. Looks like he's shot putting the ball. Appears to be a bit limited as far as his downfield range. What have you noticed on tape regarding Cam's shoulder that bettors should be concerned about, or maybe not concerned, when they're looking to handicap tonight's game?
Well, when I look at his throwing mechanics, I don't actually see a difference. Of course, he hasn't been throwing the long ball or the Hail Mary passes. As far as the rest of the stuff, I think it's been season long, and some of it may be scheme in terms of getting the ball out of his hand and the North Turner offense, et cetera, where he's actually got his highest completion percentage ever in his career. And so there's no question that his shoulder is not 100%. He did have a shoulder surgery in 2017 offseason before the season. And, you know, it certainly may be a partial cuff tear that doesn't have full strength on. But the good news is, you know, 85, if not 90% of your throws don't require maximum velocity. Obviously, Hail Marys do. And so I still think he can be effective. And one piece of relatively good news for the Panthers, this almost never happens. Injuries almost always get downgraded. Kawan Short, their D-tackle, their stud, went from doubtful to questionable. So he may actually have a chance to play.
It definitely would be a big loss if he's unable to go, knowing how important it is for Carolina to have all hands on deck defensively. One last thing, though, Dr. Chop, before we let you go, and I know there was a little bit of back and forth on Twitter, going rate for a tooth fairy. I know your young son lost his first tooth. What do we settle on for a consensus?
Yeah, that was the biggest thing of the week for him, losing his tooth. The third place chess trophy didn't matter. The New York Times picture didn't matter. The Shark Tank half second cameo wasn't that big. The tooth was the huge deal. And on Twitter, the replies I got were like $20. And I'm like, $20? The kid already has everything. My wife is smart. He's 6 years old, so she settled on $6.
I like that level of negotiation. That's kind of how pain treats me around here.
Well, I was thinking about that. I think everyone's just responding because they think, hey, doctor, this guy's loaded. Hey, he deserves $100 a tooth. But I think you're right on point there. $6 is what I was getting as a kid, a couple of dollars. And I think that was more than fair.
I mean, $6 goes a long way these days.
Well, what's he going to buy anyways? Like I said, mom's already got him everything. You know?
Always great having you on, Dr. Chow. Appreciate your time this morning. As you said, and our listeners know, they can follow you on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. They can check out all your great content throughout the course of the week to get them ready for the fantasy championships, all of their wagering activities, and your timeline is littered with a lot of great information throughout the course of gameplay and real-time information. So I want to say thanks, appreciate it, and we'll chat with you again real soon.
Thank you.
Man, $20 from a tooth fairy. I think I used to get $2 bills back in the day, and I was thrilled that I had that. Didn't know and realize back at that point the connotation from a $2 bill related to horse racing. So it does make sense now that I put it all in perspective.
See, I thought about that, and I was getting $5 at the time, and I probably shouldn't have. Inflation, right? You got to think about the inflation. If I was getting $5, you know, decades and decades ago, maybe $20 is the going rate right now.
Oh, I was thinking that you were going to take a joke and me getting $2, you getting $5 because you're significantly younger than me. So that's what I was waiting for.
No. I was thinking about that. Well, I could see why when a doctor proposes the question, hey, how much should I give for a tooth fairy, give to my kid for a tooth, that the resounding responses would be like, hey, give them the world kind of thing. But then I thought about it. And if I was getting $5 at that time, either I have the greatest parents in the world or, you know, you got to account for inflation. And so maybe $5 at that time is getting closer to at least $10 at this point, at least.
It's a very good point.
$20 might be the spot. What are you going to be giving? You're going to be shooting some out here pretty soon.
I mean, let's not get ahead of ourselves anytime soon. And no, $20 will not be the going rate. I got some Bitcoin that's burning a hole in my pocket. Maybe I can give that to people.
I'm not going to talk Bitcoin. When we were discussing this, months and months and months ago. Now, I'm not talking long term, right? I think Bitcoin could probably still be a thing long term. But we were talking just about the market like 6 months ago. It's like, hey, this thing went from $300 to 20,000. Like, there's just how every market works. Like, there's going to be a little downswing here. And man, I got eviscerated on Twitter. So I'm not going to give Bitcoin advice. But hey, if this gets to 2,800, might be time.
Yeah, we figure it out. You got to be diversified in the portfolios these days. The way the market is taking a beating, but that's a different discussion for a different day, Payne. We have a final football game to get to, but to cap off week 15, and it's quietly a good one. The Saints on the road in Charlotte to take on the Carolina Panthers. You're looking at New Orleans, a 6-point favorite at betonline.ag. Total on this game, 50. Payne, we've already seen money on not only the underdog, but also the under. First question I have to ask you is regarding the Carolina Panthers mindset.
You have multiple questions here.
All right. Well, that's all right. No. I'm gonna stop. I'm gonna stop. We talked about the number. So go ahead. Carolina's taking dog money. You want to justify the Carolina dog money we're seeing in the market, and then I can ask follow up questions like a good interviewer and host would do. Fucking asshole.
Before we get to the matchups, I think it's good, right? You know, if you're like a bettor that's looking strictly at their model, or invest like only based on power numbers, I think you're going to find value on the Panthers here, right? Like, nobody on planet Earth that has a pulse is making Carolina like +6.5 or +6 here. And then if you like, and I know you did, so I'm not phrasing this towards you, but our listeners, if you did any reading on this game, right, you would kind of see and hear the Panthers locker room is feeling and sounding a bit different in the positive way. Like, reporters and beat writers have, like, have covered the team all season, came out and be like, hey, the locker room is surprisingly, like, upbeat this week. They seem in great spirits. So, you know, again, if you're like the buy low, sell high handicapper, this is likely your pig and shit moment here, right? It's the Saints. They've covered 10 of 11. The Panthers have lost 5 straight. Prime time, of course, the number is going to be a little inflated. So the matchups now that you were getting at, who knows?
No,
this
maybe
is such a weird game.
Maybe
this
I
is
wasn't.
Such a weird game.
Maybe I wasn't getting at the matches. Maybe I wanted to talk about the Saints mindset and what it means for a team playing its third road game in as many weeks, and how the Saints' approach could potentially change. Obviously, the game plan's already been installed, but you see a game unfold like it did last night with the Rams losing outright as nearly 2 touchdown favorites at home, and the Saints have to go, wait a second, now everything is in front of us. We have a little bit of breathing room to get that number one seed, and you've talked about it at great lengths, how difficult it's going to be for any team in the NFC to go into that dome and win a playoff game against this Saints team the way they're currently constructed.
But after last night's result with the tiebreaker, a win here seals that, I'm pretty sure, right?
Correct.
This is the kind of stuff I don't really look at. But yes, so there is motivation there, obviously, for New Orleans, without question. I don't think they're short of motivation. It's a division game. They're not going to lay down. Certainly three road games in 3 weeks is difficult. And they're a different team away from that dome. But, you know, I don't – the spot – like. You know, you saw Ron Rivera this week with his 5% t-shirt. Well, first of all, your fucking t-shirt's wrong. He had greater than a 5% chance to make the playoffs, so whoever created that is brain dead. But I believe it was like a 13% chance to make the playoffs, but that's neither here nor there. But I think, you know, from that perspective of must win, both these teams have something to play for. It's a division game. Like, no one's going to lay down here. But it comes down to just the number, you know, talked to a lot of guys. Some of the pure power numbers here are like more in the 3 range. So 6.5. Who knows? I'm not saying like the bookmakers made a wrong decision here opening 6.5. Right now it's holding steady. Let's see where this goes. Obviously you don't want to open this game 3. You'll be buried with Saints money. So, but I don't think there's a situation here where like New Orleans is completely laying down. If they lose, it's just because they got outplayed. They certainly have something to play for here.
No. I wasn't
number one seed throughout and potentially having the ability to rest some guys.
I wasn't going to imply that they were going to go out here and lay down in the division. But now John Madden over there, why don't you diagram some X's and O's and tell us how Carolina keeps this game competitive?
I was really busting your balls at the beginning. You took offense to that.
I did not take offense. You know what? I'm trying to think this through. Actually, here's
my. You're being very defensive this morning. What's going on with you over there in your personal life? Everything okay?
Yeah. Everything.
I gotta play fucking quack doctor here now for you.
Everything is A-okay. The day that I'm lying on a couch to have you break down any problems in my life is the day that I might have to hang it up and.
I'm the solution for most of your problems, buddy.
Yeah, and seek alternative solutions. So we know Carolina's strength is their ability to run the football, and the Saints are strong against the run. So I don't want to start there. I want to start on the other side of the ball. We've trashed Carolina defensively and what they've done scheme-wise in that secondary. So let's look at that side of the ball and how they can slow down Drew Brees. And a Saints passing offense, it's quietly lacked a little bit of punch over the last couple weeks. They've gone under 200 yards through the air in 3 straight games.
You know, bottom line here, it's, you know, as much as the number's off here, the matchup isn't great. And that's kind of what's given me some pause here. And I think the Carolina defense, they're going to have like this anomaly type effort, you know, and you could probably have that in a 60-minute sample. You can have an outlier. But based on what we've seen this year, Steve Wilkes gone, left for Arizona, took multiple coaches with him from that Carolina defensive staff. There has been a drastic decline from the defensive side of the ball, 27th most efficient defense in Carolina, and they've really faced an average schedule of offenses, right? Guys got a little bit older. They didn't fix the secondary. They don't have a pass rush in this day and age, like 2018. If you can't get to the quarterback, it's tough to have a good defense. And I think that's partly what we're looking at here, right? Carolina 23rd in adjusted sack rate, 27th overall in pass rush. And so that doesn't bode well matchup-wise when you're going against Drew Brees. And you look at Brees's numbers when he's got a clean pocket, it's lights out. He's completing 80% of his passes. That's 3% better than the second best quarterback in Patty Mahomes. And then you can kind of flip-flop those two when it comes to passer rating with a clean pocket. Breeze number two at 131. Patty Mahomes at 136. So somehow, whether it's via the blitz, Carolina is going to have to create some pressure tonight. And for years, we've kind of outlined the kind of pressure that really impacts Drew Brees, the kind of pressure he doesn't like, and that's right up the middle. And he's probably heard about the size limitations his entire life. He's overcome them. He's one of the best passers of all time. But you can negate some of the things he does because he's 5'11" if you can get pressure right in his face. He's got to slide left or right. He doesn't really throw over it very well. So that readjustment period can really help the secondary. Maybe Riverboat Ron, no clue how he got that nickname. Maybe he dials up some blitzes tonight. You mentioned, and it's worth discussing, the Carolina defense has been good against the run. Top 10 in yards per rush allowed. Fourth in rushing success rate defense. If you can remove the ground game from that Saints arsenal without a true number two receiver, I think it can halt the New Orleans offense at times. I think the problem you're going to want to, well, potentially a problem, but something you're going to want to monitor here leading up to kickoff is the Panther stud interior lineman. He is responsible for some of those gaudy rush defense numbers. Kawan Short, he got injured somehow in practice on Thursday, injured his calf. He missed both practices after that. Overnight, he was upgraded from doubtful to questionable. So kind of let's see what happens there. If he isn't in the game, that could certainly be a big blow to the best part of Carolina's defense.
Should be that matchup be fun to watch. And then, of course, the other side where New Orleans defense has continued to be one of their strengths, and not only against the run, but they've gotten a little bit better against the pass. Christian McCaffrey, 747 total yards and 8 touchdowns during this Panthers losing skid, so he can't shoulder that much of the responsibility. But, Payne, when we look at Cam, we heard what Dr. Chow had to say and doesn't see it being something majorly physical, imposing any limitations. What have you seen from Cam Newton in this Carolina offense that's given you cause for pause in recent weeks?
You know, for me, and I'm okay saying it at this point because it's been somewhat confirmed, is somewhat pretty public, but Cam's shoulder obviously isn't 100%. And he came out and he said, hey, I may need off-season surgery here. And so while there doesn't look like, especially, and he made mention of this, which was perfect, and obviously he's familiar with Norv Turner's system, having worked with him. Norv's system is a lot of short passes. But on the deep stuff, there's a reason he's come out on some of those Hail Mary throws. If you look at the Cleveland game, about 45 yards is really his max throw at this point with decent velocity. And you look kind of over this five-game losing skid, Cam leads the league in interceptions. Balls are starting to float high on him if you're watching some of these games on the All-22. Like, and it's not like Cam's played a murderer's row of defenses during like this five-game poor run. If you look overall at some of the defensive efficiency metrics, as a whole, the Browns were the best defense Cam faced during this losing streak. They're 10th. So, you know, one thing's clear. Cam's going to need help from the ground game. He's gotten it a lot this season. Carolina is 6th in rushing success rate. But this matchup here, is, as you alluded to at the top, is good on good, right? The Saints' run defense as a whole this season's been fantastic. They allow 3.6 a rush, 43% of runs grade successful. That's a pretty low amount. But let's see who wins this battle, because both units could be a little bit phony, right? The Saints' defense, they faced the third easiest schedule of run offenses. The Panthers' offense has faced the fourth easiest schedule of run defenses. So something's got to give there. Why I'm going to kind of bring this up a little bit is it does correlate to the total you mentioned a little bit, and why it's come down from 54 to 50. It's pretty clear at this point odds makers haven't caught up with the movement like this, right? You don't want a four-point movement in a primetime game. And where the New Orleans defense has really improved this year by leaps and bounds is against the pass. And I've been kind of hinting at this the past month about trends, trend lines, trending, all that stuff. It's just so important this time of year. It's so important once you start to get just a little bit of an idea of what's going on, because things are so different, right? In week 14, week 15, they're just so different than what you saw in week 1 or week 7. So it's just it's like reason 1 million why the NFL isn't a sample size sport. But you look since week 9, which I think is more than a fair sample. It also includes the Rams game where their offense was actually clicking, and the Saints defense is 8th over that six-game stretch in passing success rate defense. So if you're looking at the full season ranking, it says 26th, but you got to get with the program now because things have changed. Explosive pass defense has also improved from being like average to better than average during that stretch as well. So that's nice. You mentioned Christian McCaffrey. It'll be interesting to see how they defend that. New Orleans defense is very good at defending the tight end position. So Ian Thomas, who had a field day last week, maybe he's a little bit more limited. New Orleans is third in both receptions and yards allowed to tight ends. The other thing, I'm going to be interested to see how that defense defends McCaffrey out of the backfield. And you look at the matchups last year, he's only had two. McCaffrey had 14 receptions in the two matchups. 9 came in the first one. He had over 100 yards, but that was kind of in junk time. The Saints won that game by 21. In the second matchup, New Orleans focused on McCaffrey, said, hey, we just got to remove this guy. He had 49 total yards on 11 touches. So he was a non-factor in the second game. If you can remove McCaffrey, Carolina offense becomes a little bit easier to defend, obviously.
There is no doubt about it. Now, because I like to throw trends out there that mean absolutely nothing, but they're fun to discuss. Look at recent history. Carolina 7-2 against the spread the last 9 versus the Saints. The underdog has covered 7 of the last 8. Payne, 7 of the last 8 between these teams have gone over the total. Panthers on a 5-game against the spread losing skid. But we look at the Saints, and this is a team that's been lining people's pockets in the NFC as well as anybody. 30-16 against the number of their last 46 games. 16-6 against the spread their last 22 on the road. And against the NFC, 25-11. So I can see why people are backing them, and we've seen the public come in on New Orleans in this particular spot at about a 65% clip. Last things that we talked about the number, I mean, we think we're going to pretty much see 6-50 more or less where we're going to stay all day.
Oof, I don't know about that. It looks like as we're actually talking up, the Saints are trending up a little bit. What are the bet splits on this game? You know, I don't really focus on that stuff.
I think 65-35 is what I saw when I checked late last night.
And the Kawhi Short injury, I would think juice-wise, if he gets announced out on the screen, there's probably a slight tick of that. Like, he's not going to, like, move the number or anything, but maybe a couple cents. But it'll be interesting to see. Maybe it gets back to 6.5. I don't think we see a spot where it gets to 7. I don't, just based on the number. But certainly, you know, Cam is not 100%. And I don't love the matchups, but there is going to be professional money on the dog here for sure.
Should be interesting to see ultimately where this game settles. Carolina's last stand, New Orleans, of course, an eye on a much bigger prize than winning tonight. But obviously we'll go a long way in terms of
the... a little under 50.5 just came in off the screen
in the NFC pecking order, but should be a good game. One definitely worth watching for sure as our nights of primetime football continue to wind down in this, the 2018-2019 season. Payne, any final words of wisdom, life advice? Do you want to hand out your shrink's number to some of their folks down there in Miami, since you were trying to coach me up off a ledge that I apparently was on, which I didn't know I was on?
Funny guy. No, the only thing I'm going to say before we part ways with our loyal listeners, this Thursday we will be doing the dual giveaway. So 2 swag packs, so 2 Visa gift cards.
Oh, baby.
And Bet the Board swag. Go to iTunes, get in your 5-star reviews. If you do, leave a nice little sentence. You will automatically be entered into this giveaway. So we'll announce those winners on the Thursday podcast in a few short days. So get in those 5-star reviews now.
Yeah, and speaking of which, we still have a handful of shirts left for a holiday order. We had some folks ask about that. So go to the website, check it out, pick them up. Supplies are extremely limited for your 2018 Bet the Board t-shirts. If you can't win them, you can buy them and support the brand that's out there. Like Payne said, Thursday we'll be back, have some of the marquee matchups. Thursday Night Football. We don't have a Thursday Night Football game. We'll have the Monday night game on that, as we will have no show next Monday on Christmas Eve, and we'll go to a Thursday-only schedule for the NFL until they hand out a Lombardi trophy in Atlanta. So special thanks to Dr. David Chow. You can follow him at Pro Football Doc. You can follow Payne Insider on Twitter at Payne Insider. I am Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And while he's not with us on Mondays, you can follow Dave Mason from BOL as well at Dave Mason BOL. Best of luck with all of your investment opportunities tonight in Charlotte when it's the Saints taking on the Carolina Panthers. And hopefully we'll see you at the window.